This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Jamie Andrews, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Hi, Jeremy. Nice to be here.
So, to start off this conversation, we have to first quickly look at the elephant in the room, and that is that you and I had an online spat, and I think there will be a number of people quite surprised seeing you and me together right now. But I think the good news is that we are guys and we sorted everything out and it's all behind us now.
I think that's it. You know, came to blows and, you know, you come out for a drink afterwards and, you know, put it all behind you. I think, you know, tempers run hot. You know, what happened in 2020, you know, really kick shit up into the air and, you know, trust is a difficult thing to come by, isn't it? You know,
yes.
And I think,
yes.
You know, I'm very good friends with a lot of South Africans, and I appreciate the South African mentality, which is just very bloody minded. You know, it's just, you know, you butt heads and when you come out the other side, you come out stronger. And so I think that's what it's all about. And I appreciate, you know, some strong pushback and, you know, we move forward and we talk about, you know, what's on the table, the kind of the bread and butter and the science really, you know, to try and discuss that. And it's good to be here. So thank you.
Yeah. So we have a few punch ups and then we have a drink.
That's it.
Okay. So this, as I said to you before we started recording, Jamie, this is a complicated conversation for somebody like me. So, tell me what it is that you're going to be telling me.
Yeah, this is it. Is that we all went through this period during, you know, 2020 where it all got chucked up into the air, and not a lot of us were privy to some of the knowledge about viruses, and that's what we're going to be talking about today: viruses, germ theory, contagion, and what happened in 2020, and all of the other viruses. Really, you know, I think we all arrived, and we all had levels of skepticism, should we put it that way? You know, levels where we had seen other things, other fabrications, hoaxes, global, you know, conspiracies, as they were, and we all arrived on different kind of levels. And but I think that you and me had a fairly similar kind of background of skepticism coming into 2020. We maybe didn't know everything about germ theory and everything about you know, how deep the hoax went with viruses. I'll just tell you my story a little bit. Back in 2018, my firstborn child, I thought that I was doing them the best for their health by getting them vaccinated. I took them in for their MMR jab, and myself and my wife noticed an immediate change after their first round of MMR. They didn't defecate for about 3 weeks. They went from holding eye contact, being the doctor actually noted that he was a very smiley baby, and went from being a very smiley, happy and engaged baby to one that would cry if anybody else came into the room, one that didn't want it to be put down, one that both myself and my wife would potentially describe as kind of on early onset autism. Now, thankfully, what happened next is that stupidly we took him back in to get his second round of injections, fully believing, you know, that maybe this was just a side effect. And my wife gave my son some Tylenol, some paracetamol to, you know, cover what we were expecting would potentially be a similar kind of reaction. And the nurse, when she was going, just before she administered them, said, "You haven't given him any paracetamol or anything like that." And we said, "Well, actually, you know, he had such kind of a bad reaction to the first lot that we did." And the words that she said from then, you know, will stay with me and my wife for the rest of our lives, was, "You didn't see what you saw. This was nothing to do with the vaccination. and you are endangering your child by giving them paracetamol. And my wife broke down in tears because they were gaslighting us as to what we had seen with our very own eyes. You know, we approached it with a very open mind. You know, we were totally of a mainstream narrative that we were doing the right thing. And so to be told that we didn't experience what we saw was astounding to us. And we picked up our child and we left. And I thank the Lord for, you know, making us, you know, revealing, you know, the sinister side to this to ourselves, because our first son made a full recovery after a few years. And I saw that a few of the things that he experienced from then on in, which was allergies and persistent colds and persistent flu-like symptoms, slowly started to cycle down. And now we have a second child who is completely unvaccinated that has experienced completely the opposite, you know, absolutely no, none of these flus, none of these colds, none of obviously the immediate effects of vaccination. So we had the control studies right in front of our faces with our two children as comparators. So I arrived into 2020 very much knowing, as soon as they said, we're rolling out vaccines, I went, no, thanks. Not for me. Not for my children. Not for anybody. Because you know, we had seen it with our own eyes. And the other part to my story was that my only kind of scientific background was studying geology at university in the UK, at Durham University, a fairly good university, a kind of Oxford and Cambridge rejects, as you were. If you were a drinking man and you couldn't be bothered to go to Oxford or Cambridge, you went to Durham. And there I was skeptical of, you know, in quotations, the system already. You know, I drank and smoked too much weed there, and, you know, just couldn't be bothered with. I was very fortunate that I got a good education before that in A-level, that something that taught me to question. And going into university was very much the opposite of that. It was just a 3-hour lecture and no questions at the end if you were still awake, you know. So as part of that, I did as part of the undergraduate degree, they told us to study Vostok ice cores, which was then known as the most accurate paleoclimate data. And it's a frozen core that they take down in an Antarctic lake, and they can study the isotopes in mass spectrometry. So oxygen 16 and oxygen 18 are the two isotopes. It's a light isotope and a heavy isotope. And they claim that if you have more oxygen 18, because in prehistoric times when it was hotter, the oxygen, the lighter oxygen isotope evaporates off, and so you have more oxygen 18 left over. And they say that that's the most indicative way of studying paleoclimates. Now, what they didn't expect us to do, they did give us the carbon dioxide data at the same time. And I, as an interested person, kind of mapped the two together. And so it shows without any shadow of a doubt that there is a lag, a kind of 600-800 year lag, almost exactly the peaks and the troughs of the oxygen isotopes follow. You know, you can put them on top of each other and then just slightly shift them to the side, and you have absolute proof that CO2 is not a driver of climate, you know. So as an 18, 19, 20 year old, I knew then that when you look at the powers that be that govern climate change, which is the UN and the IPCC, again, immediately I arrived at 2020 going, okay, well, the World Health Organization are in control of, you know, this supposed pandemic. Well, I know that climate change and everything to do with that is a complete hoax. And so, again, I kind of, the sniff test for me was arriving and going, okay, who's in control of this? It's the World Health Organization, and they're rolling out vaccines. So that's really kind of the level that I started on. But I didn't know much about you know, germ theory in general. I guess that would be a kind of, you know, similar level that you started on, that you, we were skeptical, right? But didn't really realize the full gravity of how deep the hoax would go, right?
Definitely. I mean, I think it was back in 2022 already in 2020, I started not questioning germ theory as such, but I started questioning this quote unquote pandemic and if any of it was real, because none of it made sense. I mean, I live in Africa and there's a lot of poverty here, and which means that there is a lot of poor people living in close proximity, you know, many in a small house, and many of those houses are on top of one another just about, and nothing was happening, you know, supposedly deadly contagion. And even, you know, the news headlines were, you know, experts confused, you know, and
yes, yeah, that's it. That's exactly my timeline as well. Is that, you know, I started to look at the data, and you can never really be sure with data, because it, you know, when they say there's all the rolling deaths, so this country, that it was our world in data, wasn't it, these many people have died during the day, and there's a saying, you know, lies, damn lies and statistics, and you know, we know how the government can manipulate the statistics, and obviously that's what they were doing at the time, through those big peaks, the big scary peaks that we saw. And like yourself, my wife is of mixed Indian heritage, and so we have quite a few friends that live in India, and a couple of them notably were working in charitable organizations, and I had direct contact with them through 2020. And I was just asking them, because they were on the streets of Mumbai and New Delhi, helping the poorer communities, you know, and these people, when you, like you describe in African communities too, you know, they're living in squalor. They're living in, you know, unfortunately, they're living in the horrible conditions on the streets, suffering with malnutrition, suffering with general dirt and debris in and around where they live, if they have a house at all, if it's not just on the streets. And I was asking a few of my friends coming through, because they were saying that, you know, this deadly virus had arrived and a few people had died in New Delhi. So it was in there, and if you were to look, you know, at these people, they would be supposed petri dishes for disease. You know, you would think that it would just go through and rip through everybody on the streets. And both of my friends throughout the entirety of 2020 confirmed that there was no difference whatsoever. And so it just rang these huge alarm bells. It's like, well, this is, you know, it's an overarching scientific study, really, isn't it? It's a contagion study where you kind of take a, it's not particularly controlled, you know, the environment isn't controlled, because you could have people dying from, you know, drug overdoses or, you know, all other number of ailments. So, you know, that started to get me interested, and I you know, used some of the knowledge that I took from university, which was to be able to look at peer-reviewed papers, you know, assess some of the scientific data. I knew where to look in terms of repositories, and that was Google Scholar. You know, Google Scholar contains pretty much every peer-reviewed and published paper that there is that's accessible. And I started to look for causation, you know, just, and at the time, I didn't really know what I was looking for. I knew that something must exist where they intentionally gave people viruses or you know, tried to study it in close proximity, you know, because they have epidemiological studies, which is where people get sick and then they say, okay, they ascribe the cause afterwards. So that's not really science, and epidemiologists will kind of also mostly hold their hands up and say, you know, they're attributing cause after. So a room full of people get sick, because you always hear the same thing, you know, I went to school. My children went to school, and, you know, four of them got chicken pox and so on and so forth. So they say four kids get chicken pox. That's because of a virus. Well, I wanted to learn more about the actual causality. If they take a healthy child and physically try to give them chicken pox. And so I didn't really know what I was looking for to start off with. And I just was typing in putting virus up people's noses on purpose and seeing what I got back. You know, you don't really know, but more and more, I kind of refined some of the scientific terminology. And I found out that it was called controlled human infection models. And, I found them. I found one of the first ones that I found was the Spanish flu. And what was interesting about the Spanish flu was, is that it kind of modeled a little bit, you know, of what we were seeing, what we were going through with COVID and SARS-CoV-2 is that, you know, they put in mask mandates and things like this. They tried to separate people, social distancing. Some of these things were the real kind of, you know, precursor all the way back in 1918. And this study, this particular study, was conducted by a guy called J.M. Rosenau, who was part of the U.S. Navy. And he had obviously quite a lot of facilities at his disposal. And
he got funding from the US government, I think.
That's right. So, you know, it was all above board and all very official, and was really a generalized contagion study. I think, you know, this was a real one that I was looking for, because later on they start to do it with what they consider to be purified virus in vials and everything like that, which, you know, if you're studying natural modes of transmission, it's not really that natural to take something and inject it or you know, the interesting thing about the Rosenau studies is that it was quite close to quote unquote natural modes of transmission. So they got people that were suffering with the supposed symptoms, you know, pneumonia, flu-like symptoms from the Spanish flu. And they took their mucus, they took their spit, they took bronchoalveoli lavage, which is the fluid on the chest. They took the blood. And they did everything to these healthy people. The interesting thing, just to kind of caveat, just to kind of interject into this story, is that they did it to people that were roughly of median age of 27 years old, which was the average age of death during the Spanish flu, which was, again, should be kind of ringing alarm bells, because every single other influenza, the average age of death is ironically about the average age of life expectancy. I mean, with COVID, it was 82.5, which is actually older in most Western countries than you're expected to live. So this was 27 years of age when during 1918 and 1919, the ends of the last year and the ends of World War One. And the people that they said that died from the Spanish flu, coincidentally, were 27-year-old fighting age males, exactly males that, you know, so, I mean, you know, it wasn't them being blown to bits, you know, in trench warfare. It wasn't them being, you know, gassed with chemical warfare, or there's lots of other protocols. They got them to take up to 30 grams of aspirin a day. It wasn't the vaccine rollouts before they hit the trench warfare. No. It was none of that. It was the cold virus. But they did everything that they could in this naval study over three separate areas. So they rubbed the spit and the mucus into their eyes and up their nose and into their mouth, and then got them to sit at the bed of patients, Spanish flu patients. They got them to hug and kiss and have conversations with for about 5 minutes, very in close proximity. And the stunning thing to me was, and I was looking through this all, none of them got sick. Not a single person came down with any sort of flu symptoms whatsoever. After the first time they tried it, they jigged a few things around. They were putting saline up the nose before they were trying to inoculate people with the infected sputum or infected mucus. And so they changed a few of the protocols maybe the saline is somewhat sterilizing the nasal passages. So they didn't do that anymore. They reran the experiment, and again, nobody got sick. And I sat there kind of going, right, well, that's a bit weird. If you can't do it when you're purposefully taking this stuff, what's happening? And so I found a more of a refined method of finding these papers, and I kept going and I kept finding more and more papers. And it wasn't just in the realms of influenza. It was in the more fruity, you know, viruses, the polios and the smallpox and HIV. All of these things were coming forward. And, you know, in some of these really, you know, where the propaganda is on high alert with HIV, you know, there's a study by Nancy Padian in 1997, and they follow discordant HIV couples. So one is HIV positive and the other is HIV negative. It's the largest and longest cohort study of its type, over 10 years.
It was like 10 years. Yeah, 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years. You know, that's no, when you're talking about vaccine studies, you know, it's like 3 weeks and okay, well, they're still living. You know, this is 10 years. This is a long, long time to study in terms of clinical research. And it's 175 couples again, which is quite a large cohort study. And there are no seroconversions from the moment that it starts to the 10 years later. Not a single person in sexually active partnerships transmits their HIV infection. And they log prophylactic use of under 30% on introduction into the trials. So, you know, again, this was like a real eye-opening experience for me, that it got me questioning germ theory altogether. If you can't transmit these symptoms, you know, infect people when you're directly giving them to other people, then how does it work? You know, this to me was a mind-blowing thing, that it wasn't just one-off trials. It was unanimous trials in nearly a quarter of a million people they've experimented on over the last couple of centuries. And
just
more
to be clear,
more,
just to be clear though, you're talking about viruses. You're not talking about, say, bacteria or things that you could see and play with.
Well, bacteria, the interesting thing is that there's a lot less studies with bacteria, but actually there are a few. I mean, one of them is typhoid, typhus, which is known as one of the most aggressive forms of salmonella. And I found a few of those where I pulled them up. And they give people increasing doses of typhus. And it's, if you don't get sick, then they increase the dosage. If they don't get sick, you increase the dosage. They gave it to 45 people. And out of those 45 people, they had to stop the experiment because they just kept escalating until it was kind of pure bacteria. You know, take a shower in the bacteria. I don't know, take a bath, just live in the bacteria. Not a single person got diarrhea, not a single person vomited. They registered a few people had slightly elevated temperatures. So when you're talking about, you know, food poisoning, when you're talking about salmonella, which is what they, you know, claim is the cause for food poisoning, they've given people escalating doses of this stuff and just had to call it quits because nobody got sick. The bacterial studies are slightly few and far between because they take the notion that, or, you know, they try to play the kind of moral high ground of, oh, well, we can't give them because they would be, you know, it would be unethical. I mean, they've done it with everything ranging from polio to smallpox. There's anecdotal evidence of the plague, you know, them doing control studies way back in you know, the 17th century. And but, you know, when it comes to bacteria, they can't really do it. But again, you know, that was kind of the eye-opening thing, that contagion in general, you know, passing person to person, symptomology. And for me, really personally, it alleviated a huge fear. It alleviated that huge thing that, you know, when my children were playing together, when they were going to school, when they were doing these things, you know, picking up dirt, you know, exchanging glasses, you know, and it kind of opened my eyes, really, just moving forward on a personal level, when I started to see actually how contagion works, you know, that with young children, one of the interesting things that I started to notice is that both parents never got sick at the same time. Myself and my wife would always have this kind of staggered effect, as if we had to, one of us had to be well enough to take care of our kids at any one time. So maybe my wife would get sick, then there would be a little bit of a period, and then I would get sick after that. It was as if we had to have time to be able to detox some of the environmental toxins, which I think are the cause of the symptoms, certainly of the flu that you get. The other thing to note is that there's a very, again, an observation. There's a very well-known thing that happens with teachers. I have a lot of friends that are teachers, and they go throughout the whole term time where they're very stressed. They're working 24/7. The kids are going balmy, but they don't get sick. They push all the way through, and then the holiday period comes. The moment they're on holiday, everybody gets sick. It's a well-known phenomenon amongst teachers that the moment the body relaxes, the moment it has time to actually detox, is the moment that people get sick. So almost you need that period of relaxation for your body to go through. It's a cleaning mechanism. You know, your body heats up, it has a fever to emulsify and heat up some of the fluids on your lungs that takes the toxins that you're ingesting or is in your environment. You know, the golden question that's always asked me, and if I had, you know, a pound for every time that anybody's asked me, so how do you get sick if it's not that, I say quite simply that it's everything that the germ theory tells you without a virus. You know, the medical establishment will say that if you eat McDonald's every day, you will get sick. You know, if you have a bad diet, if you drink too much, if you smoke too much, if you're too stressed, all of these things are environmental factors that lead you to becoming sick. It's just you don't need the viral story for that still to operate. It's just you ingest, okay, say McDonald's has lots of preservatives in it. You know, preservatives are chemicals like things like formaldehyde and, you know, all sorts of these aldehyde type chemicals are not good for your liver. You know, your body doesn't want them. They're synthetic things, and your liver will remove them into the bloodstream, and eventually your body will need to excrete them. And it does that by either flu. So you emulsify your the fluids in your lungs and mucus, and you cough it up. It dribbles out through your nose, or you sweat it out through your skin. And if you start to block those things, because a lot of people, you know, if you run paracetamol to try and stop them, if you're taking, you know, some of these drugs which seem to mask symptoms, you know, you think that you're doing the right thing by masking the symptoms, but actually what you're doing is you're stopping that detox process. And so if you stop that detox process, all of a sudden your body goes, okay, well, I'm trying to get rid of it, but you're stopping this, so I'm going to have to take some more emergency routes out, which is, you know, inflaming the skin with blisters and pustules and really forcing it out rather than just naturally sweating it out. All of a sudden it becomes, you know, a little bit more inflammation, and that's where you get the kind of the poxes and the rashes and the you know, some of the inflammations that you see ascribed to viruses. So that was kind of my story into finding out about germ theory and the real hoax of contagion and the contagion myth. And what kind of interested me really moving forward from then was in 1954, a guy called John Enders said that he isolated this virus. So they went from doing these contagion studies where they were putting people in rooms together with each other, and all of a sudden, John Enders took a monkey kidney cell and said that when he put the some of this fluid on this monkey kidney cell, it died, and he said, aha, that's because a virus was in this fluid. And that got used as a gold standard from 1954 right up until current day. And it's the only way to quote unquote isolate a virus. And all of the contagion studies from then on in took these cultures, so where they take an animal or sometimes human, sometimes animal cell line, they inoculate it with a supposed infected sample, and then they take this and say, okay, well, this is purified virus. And they were putting this up, you know, people's noses for contagion studies ever since and into the modern day, where they used it for SARS-CoV-2. And I mean, interestingly, when they did it with SARS-CoV-2, nobody got sick. You know, they said, in the title in Nature, where they published this study, is scientists tried to give people COVID and failed. And that's what they did. They failed outright to give anybody any sort of symptomology. Now, on the surface of it, the problem with this is that they do claim that they transmit. They claim, when you read all of these papers, on the surface of it, they say, oh, okay, 50% of people got the virus, and they do this with the PCR test. So despite people being quote-unquote asymptomatic, they say, ah, yes, this contagion study was a success because, in the case of SARS-CoV-2, I think it was about 35 or 40% of people became PCR positive. So this really started to irk me, that I was seeing a real disparity between what I would consider to be the results of the scientific tests and what they were claiming in the mainstream. The results were nobody got sick. That's the real benchmark. If you're studying viruses, I don't care if people test positive. I care if people are dying. I care if people are, you know, getting the disease, and they categorically were not. Yet they managed to bolster the entirety of the scandemic in 2020 and every single other pandemic and epidemic like HIV based on tests, based on either these antigen tests or PCR tests. And this, to me, annoyed me. I wanted to really have a look at some of the protocols and some of these methodologies. And going back to John Enders in 1954, I looked at this paper. And funnily enough, he conducts what is now an actual rarity in virology, which is a control. He took an uninoculated monkey kidney cell, and he noted that actually it died too. Now, to any kind of intellectually honest scientist, if your control fails, that should mean that your method is junk, right? If the observable effect of the thing that you are studying happens in a place where the independent variable is not input, then you get the protocol and you chuck it in the bin, right? Well, in this paper, he said, okay, well, I can see the difference in death between this and this. Well, again, if you have any sort of death that you can't attribute to the thing that you're studying, the independent variable, then still there shouldn't be a gradation between the two. So I started to look further into this, and around the same time, I think you had the same timeline as me, kind of 2021, 2022, a guy called Dr. Stefan Lanker was about. And I started to study this guy, and it was of great interest to me because he was carrying out these control experiments. He was doing them with SARS-CoV-2, taking the protocols that they had. And this guy, you know, he was no slouch. He was an accredited virologist himself. He had studied bacteriophages, which are claimed to be viruses for bacteria. They don't, even in the mainstream narrative, they don't cause disease in humans at all. And in fact, Stefan Lanker later on claimed that they were only in vitro. These things, you don't actually see them in any other environments other than stressing bacteria in a petri dish. But he was an accredited virologist looking at these things, and he conducted these studies where he took the uninoculated cultures, used the entire protocol that was used to quote unquote isolate SARS-CoV-2, and showed that the cytopathic effect, which is the death attributed in these cell lines to viral action, was happening to exactly the same degree in the same time frames with the same protocols and ingredients and methods used, thus falsifying the entire isolation part to it. So they have no benchmark for what is later on the PCR. And this is really where my head was, is that I wanted to falsify the genetics part. And Stefan Lanker, and I did a recent interview with a guy called Marvin Haberland, who has a company that helped Stefan do these controls. He put them out. And unfortunately, Stefan conducted these cell cultures and then did a genome sequencing of them, which would falsify the PCR and the whole genome. And unfortunately, the saying goes that the person who conducted them, the geneticist, was so fearful of her job, of the results that would come out, that they asked Stefan not to publish them. So these have never seen the light of day, unfortunately, the actual raw data. But Marvin confirmed, from Stefan himself, that the results were that they managed to assemble about 98% of the SARS-CoV-2 genome from these uninoculated cultures, i.e., a place where a virus could not possibly be. And this got me excited because, you know, this to me was proof. This to me was enough proof that really the fundamentals of whether a virus existed, or more importantly, the PCR test was fraudulent, i.e. the entirety, and this is where I started to formulate a project where I pulled together people and skeptics that were accredited microbiologists, accredited geneticists, accredited virologists, and biochemists. And I was meeting people online, just on Twitter, that were skeptical because of the overreach of what happened in 2020. There were lots of us kind of on the front line in the battlefield of Twitter, you know, and quite a few of those were actually working in laboratories. And I got to know a few of them, and we started to put together some of these protocols that would not only replicate Stefan Lanker's work, but maybe take it a bit further, and also kind of open source it, bring it to the general population to just have a look and have a look at what these virologists were doing. And that's what we did. About 2 years ago, I started this project where we sent off to independent and accredited labs some of these protocols to have a look. And we got back the results, and a lot of the results that we got back were just stunning to us, the initial results. And so we went full on in, I'll get up on the screen now the presentation. So this is we put together a project, about 50 of us that were researchers looking into the protocols, and we looked into what would be the we tried to steel man Dr. Stefan Lanka's work to really kind of put it to the test, we use slightly different cell lines. So we use the human embryonic kidney cell line. You can see at the top there, the HEK293T cell line. Unfortunately, they take these cell lines from all sorts of horrible places. This is from a fetus. This is done in all clinical research for drugs trials. In a Petri dish, they take these, they cut them out of sometimes monkeys, sometimes dogs, sometimes adults with tumors, and they freeze them cryogenically at minus 80 degrees, and then you can unfreeze them at a later date and then grow them out in a Petri dish. So this is what virologists do. They take the cell lines and they grow them out, and to grow them they need a thing called FBS, fetal bovine serum, which is I'll just highlight some of this. Can you see that highlight coming up on your screen? So we have 10% fetal bovine serum. So this is a concentration that is a growth medium. So fetal bovine serum is the fluid from around the outside of a baby's baby cow's heart. It's all very kind of witch doctory and witch potion type thing, taking cell lines and putting them in blood. But that's what they do. They grow these cell lines out, and in this high concentration medium, you can see that the cells grow, and we have analyzed these cells with a thing called Countess, which on the right hand side, the cell viability, live 95 and dead 5%. The Countess is a laser spectrometry machine which studies the viability of the cells, so whether they're living or dead. And there you can see that 95% of them are living, but there's a little bit of space. There's 5% space for them to grow out into. So there's a thing called confluence, and you don't want these cells to be too overgrown, to be 100%, because they start to starve each other out. So this is considered to be the negative control in our experiment, where we have given these cell lines enough nutrients to grow, and they've grown happily and healthily. And this is at day four after incubation. So you incubate them in a carbon dioxide environment in an incubator at a set temperature for these cells to grow out. And here is our test subject, where we've lowered the fetal bovine serum concentration. So every single protocol, and we studied more than 100 papers, peer-reviewed and published papers in the research and development of this. And in every single one, they reduce this fetal bovine serum on inoculation. So when virologists Here we go. When virologists inoculate with or put the viral, supposed viral including sample into the Petri dish, they stop feeding it. So they remove this nutrient source for the cell lines. So we've replicated every single one of these protocols by removing that nutrient source, which is exactly what the virological protocol does. And after day four, we can see these huge gaps starting to open up, these dead cells in the cell line, which is indicative of what a virologist would say is cytopathic effect. So you can see in some of these cells over here, you can see... You can see... the cells clumping together. You can see these large cells, holes opening up. These are set morphologies that that are indicative, supposedly, of viral inclusion. So here at the top, you can see 1x pen strep, 2x pen strep. This is penicillin and streptomycin, which are antibiotics. They're used to make a sterile, free of bacterial or fungi or protozoa potential for causing any of the cytopathic effect that you see. So it's washed with antibiotics, which, interestingly enough, are also nephrotoxic, i.e. they cause damage to kidney cells. When most virologists use kidney cells to study these things is a bit counterintuitive, because they are knowingly adding ingredients that kill kidney cells into these cultures, and lo and behold, the kidney cells die. But here you can see that the differences between left to right of these cell cultures with 1x, 2x, and 3x antibiotics washes, there's a little bit of difference, but not a huge amount. The major difference is really in the in the actual reduction of the fetal bovine serum. So here we can see that cell viability counter is red at 34% are dead now within within these cultures, which is an amount that is seen more regularly within all of these viral inoculations, is around exactly the amount that you're seeing put out by these viral hold on a second, viral inoculations in these in these studies. You're seeing an exact I need to for some reason it's state the pointer stuff has stayed on. There we go. So we did the positive control, a kind of type of positive control, by inoculating with a little bit of sputum from an asymptomatic individual to see whether the whether the introduction would cause the cells to break down any further. And here you can see at the top that the CRO, the contract research organization, the laboratory that did the study, has noted that they've seen CPE apoptosis, which is the scientific speak for cell death, and they've seen cincture, which is the cells clumping together. So these are all morphologies that are indicative, supposedly, of viral inclusion, yet there was no possibility for a virus to be included in these cells. So We know that there's no possibility of viral inclusion, because when you buy the cell lines, you buy them from the ATCC, the American Type Culture Collective, and these are banks of ingredients that guarantee non-contamination. So when you buy the cells, you get a certificate of non-contamination. So they are heat inactivated and they are PCR tested to show that they have no viral inclusions, bacterial inclusions, are limited. So you start with these reagents and you know that there is no possibility for a virus being in there. And here we see that we put 300 microliters of sputum in this, and the difference is negligible. We still see exactly the same 35% dead cells coming forward, and again that's almost exactly the same as you would receive in viral inoculations, where they're putting in what they consider to be virus. So we cross-referenced with an actual positive control. So in the build up to in the research and development of the studies that we had, we studied one particular paper which was done with exactly the same cell lines, so the HEK293T cell lines, and we used their protocol to study the inoculation method and the actual protocol that they used, so that we could use it as an AB for a positive control. So here at the top we see A, B, C, and D are cell lines that have been purposefully what they consider to be transfected, i.e. the genetics is input, infected in B with adenovirus, a type of virus. And here you can see that the cell lines have died a little bit. But when you compare them to our test culture, actually our test culture is at day four of inoculation. So this is studies at day five post transfection or infection. So they've let their cell lines go a day longer with supposed virus in them, as opposed to day four with ours, using exactly the same protocol and exactly the same ingredients taken to day four. We actually see maybe slightly even worse effects in our cultures than in the ones where they put the supposed virus in. The reason for that being is potentially that when they put these infection mediums in, they're putting cells in, and sometimes those cells can provide nutrients for the other cells around them. So actually, you know, the infection sample might actually be doing them some sort of good, because they were worse in ours. So we actually took video. The laboratory that carried out the experiments did every single methodological procedure. They video documented it so that we didn't want to reveal the name of the laboratory or the person that conducted the experiments, because there are lots of people that don't like what we do and would try to harass or dox the laboratory or the person that did it. So we wanted to keep them anonymous, but we wanted to have the protocol and have the methodologies on show for the general public to be able to engage with them and to actually see that we're doing legitimate science, not like the virologists. So here is here's the technician describing it, and there's no sound, so I'll just say it. This is 10% fetal bovine serum plated, has reached confluency. So that's spread out. Would need to replace the growth medium to avoid cell death if continuing for a few for a few more days for some space between the cells to be visible. So he's noting that there's space for it to grow out. Some ballooning cells, so the cells have kind of lifted off, but that's normal. Some dead cells as well, just a few little ones in there. This is the negative control, but they never grow absolutely perfectly. But as you can see, we're going to switch to the 2%, the test cell line. So immediately, this is day four at 2% fetal bovine serum. Cells are not near confluency. Cell morphology is different. Lots of islands of what might be cells growing on top of each other. Lots of floating cells. Examples of floating cells. More so than in the control. The cells are dying. Strange structures appear as well. The growth medium still appears to have nutrition because it hasn't changed color. There is still room for the cells to grow. The cells just are not growing very well with 2%. Now we'll look at 2% fetal bovine with two times penicillin streptomycin. So that's additional antibiotics. Looks similar to the previous well. Can see lots of dead cells. They're floating around. Again, islands that look like cells are growing on top of each other. This is cincture or placking. Also strange morphology like ballooning. These could have been described as infected with viruses, as seen in some publications. This is a clean culture, as evidenced by the controls. Floating cells that are dying, large cells, small cells, ballooning cells. The cells are not spreading out as we saw in the stock flask. A bunch of dead cells. They did not grow nearly as much as the control. There you go. So that's the lab technician pointing out the exact morphologies of what they claim is indicative of a viral addition. We wanted to take it a bit further. We did these in 90 cultures, cell cultures exhibiting cytopathic effect in all 90 of those cultures without fail. And so to us, we were expecting those results because we had some idea, knowing that Stefan Lanka had done these types of experiments before, and we'd seen John Enders debunk himself in his own cell culture protocol. But we wanted to go further and actually have a look at some of these under microscopy. So we sent them off these cultures, gave them to a microscopy lab to have a look at we didn't want to let on that we were studying what we were, which was, you know, trying to look for viral-like particles. We wanted to leave it unbiased. So we sent it off to a microscopy lab and told them to look for extracellular vesicles, which are just the small kind of globules that you get in cell lines. When the cell line starts to break down, they bubble off a bit like a lava lamp, because they're lipid coated vesicles that are hydrophobic in water, a bit like an oil in water. You get them in small globules. So we gave them the remit to study or to have a look at extracellular vesicles in our cultures. So here, the project background, the project report. We've got the sample. So there's the pellet in the Eppendorf tube that we sent off. They used the ultra microtome, which is a specific, very precise kind of knife to cut this pellet into a very small section. They used a specific type of electron microscope to have a look, and they described the protocols that they used. And so this was one of the images that they gave back of the extracellular vesicle. You can see that it's large and empty, not a bit misshapen, but not particularly exciting. This was clarified as an extracellular vesicle, which is an important point to make because this definitely doesn't look like a virus or anything. It's far too big for a start. It's about 2,000 nanometers in size. So. But we did look further amongst the 9 pictures that they gave us back. And in those 9 pictures at the top here, you can see labeled what looks to be exactly like the SARS-CoV-2 particle. Here you see from the National Institute of Health what is meant to be the size of a SARS-CoV-2 particle, 60 to 140 nanometers. This particle is round, if we can just describe it. It's round. It has slightly darker patches of what could be considered protein inclusions within it in a circular fashion. It has a coating around the outside, a supposed protein coat. And it's, I've pulled up the chart for you to see the bar graph, a size graph to see how big this virus is, which is around 100 nanometers, which is exactly in the ballpark of what SARS-CoV-2 is claimed to be. Here at the bottom, we can see what the CDC claim is an Omicron subvariant of SARS-CoV-2 in purple there. So again, it's round, it's got these kind of darker protein inclusions, and looks almost identical to the particle that we found in the uninfected culture. Again, here in the bottom, we have our cultures. It's just, again, 1 of 9 that we have. So if we can describe this this particle, it's oval in shape. It has a protein, a kind of protein inclusion, a kind of they're dotted around, they're more sporadic, there's no particular clustering to them. There's a matrix, which is a lighter colored inclusions to them, and it has a coating around the outside. At the top here, we have this, what the CDC considers to be a measles virus, which is, again, if we describe it, it's oval in shape. It's got a viral membrane. It's got these protein inclusions, phosphoprotein and glycoprotein inclusions that are not particularly clustered. They're sporadically dotted about. And so here we can see we've offered up a size chart to this viral-like particle that we found. Here we see that the National Institute of Health says that the measles is 120 to 250 nanometers in diameter. And next to the bar chart that we have, it shows that it's roughly about half the size of the bar chart, showing that it's a larger measles virus, or what could be considered to be a viral-like particle of 250 nanometers in size. This was the overall image that we were given from the microscopy lab, and you can see it just down here in the bottom right, that that particle is found. Here again, it's from just 9 of these images that we found. So here is the CDC's version of what they call the HIV viral particle. So again, if we can describe it, it looks a little bit like a fried egg. So it's round in size. It has a denser nucleated type center to it of darker proteins, and it's got a shell around it, a protein shell. They say it's approximately 100 nanometers in diameter. And here, this is our this is an image from our image zoomed in. You can see a viral-like particle, a fried egg type shape. It's roughly spherical with a darker nucleated part to it. It has a coating around the outside, and if you compare it to the size chart at the bottom, you will be able to fit roughly 5 of those particles inside of it. So it's about 100 nanometers in diameter, which is absolutely identical to what the CDC claim is HIV. And this is not a new occurrence. Here we have back in the HIV days, O'Hara et al. On the left hand side, you have an AIDS related patient exhibiting these fried egg type particles, the round with the nucleated protein inclusions in them. And on the right hand side, a healthy individual with exactly the same inclusions in them. So here we have in healthy chick embryos hundreds of these type particles, HIV looking particles. And then at the bottom here we have in the top section Galashnikov et al, which was in 1997, where they actually studied the protein inclusions and found that the exact same proteins were in the uninfected cells as they were in the infected cells. In the top section we have, again, this was supposedly the infected section, we have identical particles to ones found in the controls in C at the bottom. So from these 9 images that we have, we've managed to cross-reference 3 supposed pandemic and epidemic causing viral particles in places where these viruses should not be. I would say that it is just cell debris. When you get cell lines that break down in the Petri dish, they blob out, and all of this material that's inside of the cell line just escapes from the cells in different random spherical patterns, and the virologists are pointing and declaring at these shapes and claiming that they are viruses. It's really as stupid as that. That it's just cell debris that they are misattributing to being called viruses. And when you can cross off the physical nature of these viruses, what they look like, I would say that you have said that they are no longer in existence, or those things that they claim are viruses. I describe it as this: if somebody claims that Bigfoot exists because they have a picture of a man with a particularly hairy back, if you happen to know that that photo is of your Uncle John, you can prove that your Uncle John with a hairy back walking to the garden shed is actually the man in the photo and not Bigfoot, then you have shown that the physical evidence of Bigfoot existing is incorrect. Therefore, you have shown in that instance that Bigfoot does not exist. There's obviously a lot of epidemiological questions to go with that. Sorry, you wanted to...
Yes. So to the layman, what you're showing here is where there isn't supposed to be these alleged viruses, you're finding particles that look exactly like those alleged viruses.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So we've zoomed in with electron microscopy, and the laboratory had complete control over the images. We were not allowed to kind of say, oh, look over there, go and show us this part of this cell line. We just got these images back, and out of those 9 images, we found these things that look absolutely identical to viruses. You know, it really wasn't too much of a difficult thing. You know, it wasn't like we tried this 100 times and, oh, we've, you know, slowly found a fuzzy image of one. You know, it was within the first try in 9 images. So, I mean, moving forward, I would like to do some more of these to cross more of these viral-like particles off of the list. But yeah, in essence, that's exactly it. That you know, we've had a look and found these, what they call to be viruses in a dish where they cannot possibly be.
So what you've done in a weird way is proved a negative.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, we talked about this. There's, you know, there's an epistemological. There's lots of epistemological issues with proving a negative. I've written an article recently. Because the idea that, you know, you can prove a negative, or that you can categorically say that something doesn't exist, is sticky ground. Because, you know, in the case of Bigfoot, for instance, you can say, okay, we've crossed off the picture, it was Uncle John with a hairy back, so we've shown that it wasn't. But Bigfoot could always be in the next forest. There are, yes, uncharted forests in the middle of the Amazon that maybe Bigfoot is there. We don't really know. And so there is an
You would need to find every single scenario.
Exactly. And really, that is, it is a question of infinity, because even when you were there, you could always say Bigfoot is, when we went to that last remaining forest that we've checked, in the time that we were checking, he moved, right? You know, you can kind of keep moving the ball further down the stream. And so I think that it's indicative, it's really on a personal level. And this is why I think it's crucial to kind of show these things to the public and show the experiments and put everything in as transparent a way as possible by videotaping it, by documenting it, by letting people get involved in these science projects. Because I think on a personal level, I think it comes to a point where you just need to be satisfied yourself. Like, I was satisfied myself by when I saw the results of the experiments. You know, for me, I know that we gave them to an independent laboratory, and when I got them back, because we didn't know what we were going to get back, you know, with Stefan Lanka's work, we knew roughly that we would see these cell lines dying. But when it came to the microscopy work, that for me really solidified in my own mind, right, okay, well, these things quite clearly are bullshit. You know, that was it. You know, it was just like, right, well, we've seen this particle right here. For me, that was enough to go, okay, they don't exist. You know, I'm happy to put a kind of a stake in the ground and just go, those viruses that we've crossed, I'm happy that we don't need to look much further. You know, it comes to a kind of collective thing where, you know, maybe, and obviously we talked about this in, you know, beyond reasonable doubt. In a law court, they will say, beyond reasonable doubt, you've looked enough to say that something doesn't exist anymore, that the general consensus should be that it's not worth looking for a Bigfoot anymore, you know. But these are kind of, this is kind of an issue with societal, cultural, you know, on a personal level, I just say it's been enough to convince me.
Or you could say they do exist, but by another name.
Exactly. You could say that they've been mislabeled. You know, that in and of itself is a truism. You know, these are mislabeled cell debris.
But there's another interesting dynamic, and that's not really part of this discussion, but even if they take that little particle and they point an arrow at it, and they say, right, that is HIV, they still have to show that that exact particle can be transmitted into somebody else, and then it must, after that, create a particular kind of illness.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's Koch's postulates, you know, and something that, you know, is a very basic level of proving a pathogenic virus or a pathogen in general. You know, it's Koch's postulates are kind of the lowest threshold of what you should need to prove something. It's kind of like, you know, can you describe something as a car? Has it got four wheels? You know, has it got a steering wheel, an engine, and can it, you know, can it drive you from A to B? You know, that's really the low end that Koch's postulates are, yet they haven't managed to satisfy any of them by, as we saw with HIV, you know, the Padion studies, they can't transmit it. So, you know, in terms of, the project that I'm running is not really here to say, okay, we've proved that viruses don't exist. The focus is to show that the PCR tests and the tests are fraudulent, to prove that the tests are fraudulent, because there is a finite that you can control for a test. When a test says that something measures it in the way that it does, if you can falsify that test, then you can prove that that test is not testing for what it claims to test. And this is up on the screen at the moment. If we can just listen to this, this is with the rapid antigen tests that we studied. So here we have a rapid antigen test that we tested with Volker.
I can't hear anything. Just so you know.
No, there is no sound on this. It's been taken off. Okay, so great. I'll talk over the top of it. Yeah.
Okay.
So at the top, there's a video saying that the rapid antigen tests, the children found out, some children from the UK found out that they could bunk off school by putting Coca-Cola or orange juice on these tests. And there was a whole safety mechanism ran out by the medical and political institutions saying, well, that's because it's acid. The acid breaks the tests. Now, we ran it again with vodka, which is pH neutral. It's about 7, which is almost identical to the pH of the body, and tried it on a rapid antigen test of COVID-19 and influenza A and B. And as you can see, coming up on the on this test already, you have the test line registering positive for COVID-19 and influenza B and A, and the control line, which means that it's a valid test. You can just see it poking through the test. So, you know, when a test claims, and the rapid antigen test as these are, claim that this measures for very specific antibodies that are present in your body, they are on this touch paper, and when a sample that supposedly contains the matching antigens, it matches up, and you get a positive. Now, there is no way that vodka, because it is known to be sterile, you know, vodka is an alcohol which is used at high concentrations to sterilize, because it kills supposed viruses. You know, it's like hand gel. You know, hand gel is considered to be totally sterile. So with these tests, we have shown that it can't possibly be acid that's breaking the tests, because these are this is pH neutral. It can't possibly contain a virus. And so we have shown that those rapid antigen tests are fraudulent. So here we started to look at the PCR test. So in 2020, we have been falsifying the PCR test and looking at some of the rollout during mass testing. In the United States, this is Science magazine, one of the largest publications on biology. They say that when they rolled out the PCR test to laboratories in the US during mass testing in 2020, the primer kits that they use, so the primers are the small supposed target sequences that find the genetics of the virus that they use, those primer sequences that they ran out in the negative control amplified. So amplification is where you get a supposed positive signal. So you get an exponential rise of the fluorescent dye that they put into the PCR test. It's a fluorescing dye, and then there's a camera that picks up the fluorescence. And when that fluorescent dye is seen, it's said that they found the specific virus in, or the specific target sequence to denote a virus. Yet when they rolled these out in 2020, their negative control was amplifying. Now, let me explain what that is. Is the negative control is just water. They don't add a sample. They just have what's called nuclease-free water. So they use specific enzymes and they filter out water to make sure that there's no DNA in the water. And these were testing positive. So in most, but not all of the state labs. So they show that they've actually debunked the PCR test themselves by testing positive with water. Now, some will note that the other anecdotes of what happened in 2020 was there was an African leader who did PCR testing quite comically of goats and motor oil and a papaya, all coming back positive. I forget the name of that African leader right now. It was on the tip of my tongue beforehand, but
he was the president of Tanzania, I think.
Tanzania, that's right. Yeah, it'll come back to me again. It'll jog, but we both know who we're talking about. So yeah, when you're running these control studies, taking things that cannot can possibly contain a virus, yet they are testing positive, that falsifies the test itself. And so here's some of the anecdotes that I found online from lab technicians studying these PCR tests. So here, mixed up a tube and ran bacterial control with a viral primer. So this is like a positive control. So in the positive control, they take what's considered to be a pure target sequence. So if I could explain it or put it into context, if you designed a test that was to look for an apple in a fruit salad, the positive control would be an apple. So you would find it every single time in the test in its most purest format. So the positive control is pure target sequence. And here, these lab technicians are using pure target sequence from something not, or something different to what they're studying. So mixed up tubes and ran a bacterial control with viral primers, and it tested positive. So it's testing positive for completely different types of things that they're studying. Again, below, accidentally used a plasmodium oligo with our lab standard human actin primers. So they're studying completely different supposed sequences and getting positives. And that brings us on to what they're actually studying, what they're actually looking at within PCR. I've written an article about what is the PCR actually testing for. Well, they tell you, because in a PCR, if you get unexpected results in PCR, you have to take it through to what's called gel electrophoresis. It's a really shit and really quite comical thing. It's just a dish here with some battery electrodes sticking into them, literally DC battery electrodes, like a car volt battery, 12 volt battery. And you have a dish that has a gel in it. So like an agarose gel, a little bit like agar jelly, or you know, like a home jelly that has very small pores into it. And they put electricity between those two gels. And when some of the particles within the sample move to the anode, the positive electrode, they say that's because DNA is negatively charged. Well, here, just checking with ChatGTP, DNA is negatively charged, which is why it moves towards an anode in gel electrophoresis. DNA is negatively charged due to its phosphate backbone, which causes it to move towards the positively charged anode during gel electrophoresis. But principally, it only works based on charge. Yes, you're right in the sense that charge is the fundamental driving force behind gel electrophoresis. Without charge, the technique wouldn't work at all because it relies on electric field. So what they're clarifying is that the actual thing that they tell you that they are measuring is charge. And then the story behind the charge is all these, you know, mental things that they come up with as to why they are measuring charge. You could say that you could input any story into the reason as to why they are measuring charge. The reason why it moves towards the anode could be because leprechauns carry them on their backs towards it, or, you know, unicorns fly these things around. It just so happens that they've told us that DNA is in this thing, and there's a specific code for life, but what they're actually measuring is charge. And so this is what we're falsifying at the moment, is the PCR part to it. This is where we are with the project is looking at, and we have run the genetics side of this. We conducted 6 whole genome sequences, and we've got the results back from those. And we're keeping some of this to ourselves for the moment because it's kind of the crucial part to the project. But what I can tell you is that we have absolute proof that the PCR test does not measure what it claims to measure, i.e. small genetic sequences. And so we're getting these verified. We want to dot all of the I's and cross all of the T's to make sure that we're, you know, it's got serious, as it were, because this is kind of the end part to it, you know, where we are saying, you know, look, they have faked a pandemic with a PCR test. You know, they have killed a lot of people by telling them that they have viruses, by, you know, conducting all of these medical procedures, you know, giving people remdesivir, putting them on ventilators, and, you know, a lot of the things that we saw during 2020, and you know, pushing vaccines on them because of this claimed spread, which is all based on the PCR test. So that's the point that we're up and up until, and I'm also doing some PCR testing, like we did with the antigen test, where we're trying stuff that cannot possibly contain a virus, and looking to see if we can get positives. And we've got some very positive results from those that we'll be releasing soon.
I have no idea what to ask you.
It's, I think from a visceral level, the you know, a lot of people say that you're kind of engaging in the sophistry of virology, you know, by doing these, by going into the labs and doing what they're doing, you know, you're saying that cell cultures can be legitimate science. And I fundamentally disagree with that. You know, what we're doing is falsifying their methodology. I don't believe that a Petri dish can show you what's going on in your body. Yeah. When they look at a Petri dish and when they're saying they're taking the cells out of the whole, yeah, they're taking, I think that the body, you know, the whole picture of a body is something that is very difficult to study. And certainly when you're looking at it on a very microscopic level with none of the other inputs, I don't think that that's indicative of anything. And so, you know, that's one of the things that has kind of been leveled at me and the project is that you're engaging with the you know, virologists and the sophistry of virology itself. And I think that we're just falsifying and we're saying this does not work. This we have shown that categorically it cannot be attributed to a virus. It cannot be attributed to any of the things that you're doing. And so I would say that the entire process is falsified.
Well, that means that you'll have to come back onto my show at a later stage with some updates.
That's it. Yeah, please. I really love that.
Okay, for now, this has been a long conversation, so let's come in for a landing. My eyes are already taking strain from the lights in front of me. So, so Jamie, how can I keep up with this project? I mean, how can I follow you?
I'm releasing all of the results on Substack. That's at Control Studies on Substack. I'm doing articles that is, you know, more on the theoretical side, kind of pulling it apart. But we've released all of the results of the 90 cultures. We've released all of the images taken from transmission electron microscopy. I'm releasing all of the PCR work that I'm doing on that Substack for free, totally open source, that you can take and use yourself as well. You know, we want people to be able to use the results for their own purposes. You know, I work with a lot of people that are taking them to their local government institutions to say, you know, look, this is some science that I've been a part of because it's open source. You can say that you can use this and take it and use it in any way that you deem fit. And so I want people to have this this work and be able to use it themselves to make sure that 2020, you know, never happens again. So that's all on Substack. I'm on Twitter. You can reach out to me on either of those platforms and just ask any questions and kind of, you know, get involved as well, because I want people to be able, you know, not to scare people off with the jargon of science. You know, I think that's what a lot of like scientific institutions try and do, is just baffle you with the bullshit. And I want to be able to explain it as a layman, because I went through it myself, going from knowing none of the jargon to, you know, understanding it, to be able to talk to these laboratories on their own terms. And so I want to be able to educate people and dispel the fear around just approaching the science and being able to look at it in a logical fashion themselves. So ask me any questions about it and, you know, engage with it.
Jamie Andrews, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you so much, Jeremy, for having me on. And look forward to future interviews and future being able to, you know, announce some of the stuff that we have going on.